Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today we take you to Thompson's Point in Portland for Maine Conservation Voters Evening for the Environment. We join Maine Conservation Voters first to recognize Maine sportsman and writer George Smith for his environmental advocacy efforts. Then we'll hear the keynote address from Brian Deese, senior advisor to former President Obama and a negotiator in the Paris Climate Agreement. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. And this program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Commencing the program today is Maureen Druin, Executive Director of Maine Conservation Voters and Maine Conservation Alliance.
Now, tonight's program will recognize sportsmen, writer and conservationist George Smith, who is here with his family. George. Woo-hoo. And we'll hear from Brian Deese, who helped negotiate the Paris Climate Agreement. Pope Francis asked in his encyclical on the environment, "What kind of world do we want to leave to those who come after us, to children who are now growing up?" Well, Maine Conservation Voters and Maine Conservation Alliance are committed to protecting the natural legacy we leave to our children. But we couldn't do it without all of you. Thank you for being here tonight, for celebrating our common home, and for being on the front lines for our kids, our environment, and our way of life. Thank you.
In a few minutes, I will introduce George Smith. But before that, we have a special guest who has tape-recorded some remarks.
You guys are giving George Smith a conservation award? Seriously? Well, it is seriously, actually. George, I think I had you there for a minute. George, I can't think of anybody better than he to get this award. I remember when I was a kid, my father was a member of something called the Isaac Walton League, which was a fishing organization, and we used to go to their dinners, and it always said on the menu or on the plate or something, sportsmen are the original conservationists, and in a sense, that's true, and I think George really epitomizes that. He's certainly a sportsman. Hunting, fishing, enjoying the outdoors in Maine has been George's life since he was a little kid trailing Ezra around in the woods west of Augusta. He has also advocated for the environment in Maine. He was one of the real fathers of the Outdoor Heritage Fund, which we put together when I was in Augusta, and it was the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine and the Maine Audubon Society. I mean, that was an unheard of coalition in those days, and I think that's an indication of George's skill as a leader and as a builder of consensus. George has always been strong when he was at SAM, and now that he's a writer and travels around the state, I know him very, very well. If I know George, he probably has some of his books for sale outside. One of them I wrote the foreword for, and George made the mistake of sending me a box of the books and said, "Could you sign these books, you know, as part of the, when we sell them, you know, I'll sign them and you'll sign them." So he wasn't there, so I wrote underneath my foreword, "You've now read the best part of the book. You don't really have to bother with the rest, Angus King." So that'll teach George to leave me on my own for a chore like that. I also can't help but note that this is the Harry Richardson Award. And I knew Harry in the 70s. He really was one of the fathers of the, here I am using that again, one of the ancestors, if you will, of the conservation and environmental movement in Maine. People like Harry Richardson, Hottie Hildreth, David Huber, and others were, and Sherry Huber, of course, were really there at the beginning, back in the 70s when we were struggling with so many important issues and so many principles were laid down that have guided conservation and environmental protection in Maine ever since. So for George to get the Harry Richardson Award is really a special moment. I think it's meaningful. I think it is absolutely appropriate, and I wanted to congratulate George, and I suspect Edie may be there, and even Gordon. So wonderful family, all, you know, Ezra and also George's mom really established these kids with a love of Maine and a love of the outdoors in Maine. Finally, I've gotten your hopes up now. Finally, I want to congratulate the conservation voters of Maine. What you're doing year in and year out, day in and day out, is so important to protecting the wonderful outdoor experience, the quality of life, the environment, however you want to define it, which is so much a part of what Maine is and who Maine is. And I just want to thank you so much for that work, for the attention to the issues, to the kind of day-to-day work at the legislature. And I see you down here, so I know how serious you are about the issues on the national level. I look forward to continuing to work with you, but then I want to go back to the beginning and congratulate George Smith. George, I can't think of anybody who deserves this award better. It's an honor for me to be able to add my words to those of many others tonight who believe in what you've believed in and who have supported you and the work that you've done over the years. Congratulations, George. You're the man.
You are the man. Welcome, and thank you for being here. My name is Beth Ahern, and I hold the titles of Political Director for Maine Conservation Voters and Program Director for Maine Conservation Alliance. It is my honor and privilege to introduce George Smith, who many of you know, or many of you know at least of George, and I bet that many of you are here tonight because you heard about the evening through George. He's a very powerful one-man marketing team. I met George in 1992 when he began as the executive director of the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine, and I was lobbying for Maine Audubon. And that was the time, as the senator said, when conservationists and sportsmen were perceived as enemies, and George worked hard to bring our communities together. It was his idea, and we worked together to create the Maine Outdoor Heritage Fund that the senator talked about, to create a revenue source for wildlife programs. George has worked tirelessly for many years on many issues. And he does it through force of personality. George has boundless energy. He has tremendous passion, tenacity, charm, and smarts. And he never gives up. George and I didn't always agree. And it wasn't fun being on opposing sides. Did I mention that the guy's tenacious? But over the time, agreement has become more common. George has many opinions that he shares liberally about many issues. You all know that. But he has the ability to change his mind. He once was opposed to Alewives passing up the St. Croix River, but he changed his mind and proclaimed in a public hearing that he had been wrong. He once opposed the creation of the Maine Woods and Waters National Monument, but now he's a fervent proponent. How humble and inspirational is this? George has done many things. He works on climate change. He's worked to protect brook trout, wildlife habitat. He's worked on domestic violence issues, and you know, he raises money for libraries from Millinocket to Mount Vernon in his spare time. George is a huge lover of life with a capital L. He loves his family foremost, he loves his community, and he loves the grand state of Maine. Like another George, George Bailey from It's a Wonderful Life, he's made a difference in the community that he calls Maine. George has made Maine a more special place. I feel fortunate to be able to call him my friend. George, would you please come up? Here's the award. It is with great pleasure and affection that I present you with the Harry L. Richardson Environmental Leadership Award of 2017 for writing, speaking, advocating, and inspiring us to protect the Maine woods, waters, and wildlife. Congratulations, George.
Thank you. Thank you. Awesome.
We also have a celebratory backpack donated by L.L. Bean, especially for you. It's got the Inland Fisheries and Wildlife emblem on it. You're right up there. Yeah. Nice. Now, George has promised he's going to keep his remarks short, but any of you know George? No, that's going to be tough.
Sit down. Don't sit down. Wow. Really overwhelmed. And I got to thank you first for the award. It does mean a lot to me, especially because I knew and worked with Harry Richardson, a wonderful man and leader. And I think the award is an important recognition that sportsmen and women share the same values and goals with environmentalists. We are all environmentalists, from protecting wildlife habitat to securing our best places to addressing climate change. We all share those goals as Mainers. I'm especially pleased to have so many friends and family members here tonight, particularly my grandsons, Addison and Vishal. Tonight they can see that I am more than just grumpy grampy. And I didn't intend to tell any Angus stories, but I've got to. I worked on his first campaign for governor, and they wanted a real Mainer to do an ad for him, so he picked my dad, filmed the ad right in his living room in Winthrop, and Dad's message was fairly simple. Yes, Angus is from Virginia, but he's still okay. When they aired that ad, Angus went up 5 points in the polls. And he and Dad became wonderful, wonderful friends. Some of my greatest days were spent hunting and fishing with my dad. We hunted together for 53 years, a very special privilege. It was no accident that I spent my career advocating for sportsmen and women and writing about hunting and fishing. I want to tell you a couple stories, and I know Maureen's a little concerned I might talk too long, so I keep it short. When I started lobbying for the Sportsman's Alliance in the early 1990s, the first person to reach out to me to help me was Beth Ahern, at that time the lobbyist for Maine Audubon. Beth really taught me how to lobby. I joke that she may have later regretted that. But truthfully, we've worked together on many issues over the years. Beth and I even appeared in a TV ad together for a Land for Maine's Future bond issue. One late June, after a frustrating legislative session in which we failed to get funding for some important conservation projects, I was up to our Northwoods camp fishing, thinking about that, and I decided that we really needed a new funding source for conservation projects. The SAM board endorsed the idea, and I took it to Maine Audubon, which partnered with us on the initiative. We took a poll to find out what funding source the public preferred, what programs and projects they would like to fund with that money, and then we prepared the initiative and collected signatures to put it on the referendum ballot. We won the support of Governor Angus King and were surprised and delighted when the legislature enacted it instead of sending it to the ballot, only the second time that had ever happened. Sally Stockwell of Maine Audubon and I served on the board of the Heritage Fund for the first 10 years. The fund gets its money from an instant lottery game and has awarded more than $20 million in grants to conservation and outdoor recreation projects. I'm particularly proud of my work to recognize and protect our native brook trout. We have almost all of the brookies that are left in lakes and ponds in our country. When I was at SAM, we proposed legislation to establish heritage waters where native brook trout would be protected. The Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife opposed the bill, but we overcame that opposition and we got it enacted. The heritage waters initially numbered 300 and now number over 500 and include protection of Arctic char. Since leaving SAM 7 years ago to write full-time, I've continued to be active at the legislature. This year I proposed 11 bills and had some luck with them. I proposed 2 native brook trout bills, one to extend protection to heritage water tributaries, and another to speed up the process of adding new waters to the protected list. The department opposed my bills, but the legislature's IFW committee embraced them, forcing the department to promise to achieve all of our goals within 6 months and report back to the committee in February. And the committee kept one of my bills alive in case the department fails to keep that promise. I also helped lobby for many other important pieces of legislation, from bills to help Maine immigrants to the mining and public lands bills. If you have the time, you really can be effective at the legislature as an individual. Believe it or not, we did accomplish some great things this session. I think the mining bill, years in the making, was probably our most important accomplishment. We now have the strongest mining rules in the nation. Linda and I were birding in Arizona last April. I was astonished to find rivers that had no water in them. I have a photo of a river sign on a bridge across a river, but there's no water in that river. In fact, it's filled with trees. And I was told that ranchers and miners take all that water. We are so blessed in Maine to have such strong conservation groups, from local land trusts to state organizations, including the Maine Conservation Voters, Natural Resources Council of Maine, Maine Audubon, and the Sportsmen's Alliance of Maine. I must thank each and every one of you for all that you do to protect and enhance our wonderful state. Every one of you deserves an award, including the great staff at the Maine Conservation Voters. But one person here tonight deserves special recognition. That's Beth, who continues her long and successful lobbying career, working now on behalf of the Conservation Voters. She has dedicated a lot of her career to making sure I don't make mistakes, that I stay on the right side of these issues. So I'm going to share this award with Beth tonight. Finally, you all know how important Maine's environment and wildlife are to each of you and to many of our summer residents and tourists and economy. I think we have to recognize that in spite of all the great work we've done, there's a lot more to do. Let's take moose as an example. Most of us and all of our tourists enjoy seeing moose, but they're dying in large numbers from winter ticks. Moose watching businesses are having a hard time finding moose to show their customers. And while we are finally doing the necessary research to understand the numbers of moose that are dying, we've done nothing to save them, nor do we have a plan to do that. In closing, we have many environmental challenges ahead, topped by climate change, something I write about a lot. At a climate table event in September, I suggested that we put the photos of young children on every climate change column and handout because we must solve this problem for our children and our grandchildren. If we fail to do this, they are the ones who will suffer and eventually blame us for failing to act. Seriously, we're all on this planet together, and the natural environment sustains us. We can't afford to fight about this. Something for you to think about and join us in addressing. Thank you.
When we return, Brian Deese delivers the keynote address. Stay with us. You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Welcome back to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Right now we're with Maine Conservation Voters for An Evening for the Environment. Continuing our program is Jen Burns Gray, Board President of Maine Conservation Voters.
Good evening. My name is Jen Burns Gray, and I am Maine Conservation Voters Board President. And I, again, thank you and welcome you for coming. And my role is to say goodbye and thank you to two departing board members. Lucas St. Clair is leaving as Maine Conservation Voters Board President, and Karen Harrell is leaving Maine Conservation Alliance Board as Board President next month. Both of these leaders have guided the organization with passion, dedication, and intelligence. Karen, having served on the board, both boards, double duty, both Maine Conservation Alliance and Maine Conservation Voters since 2010, has shown her real passion and love for the outdoors, shared her leadership skills, her attention to detail, as well as her tremendous passion for the wildlife and wildlands of Maine. Lucas has served on the board for the Maine Conservation Voters since 2013. He has been an outstanding, committed, and talented board member, while at the same time having this other gig as leading a very successful campaign to have our Katahdin Woods and Waters Monument declared. Yay. He's also just happened to have served on our events committee, helping to grow and expand this event we have here tonight. He's also recruited our speaker for this evening. So I'd like to thank both Karin and Lucas on behalf of both organizations for their dedication and their service to both boards. Can you please come up and receive your thank yous?
So it's hard to leave an organization, but it makes it so much easier to know that it's going to be in good hands. We have an amazing staff, and Jen, thank you for taking over the helm of leadership and being the board chair. It means a lot to me and makes this transition much easier. So I have the unique privilege to introduce our speaker tonight. I first heard rumors about Brian Deese in 2015. He was a young guy with some connections to Maine, and he had taken over a senior advisory role for President Obama. People keep telling me he's the new John Podesta, and I should get to know him. He's now the guy that has the president's ear for all things conservation. A good friend of mine was running this Council for Environmental Quality and worked for Brian, so I thought I'd try to get a meeting. Maybe I could talk to him about this project I was working on in northern Maine, and maybe we could make some headway. And I tried for a year to get this meeting, and it never happened. It turns out he's a really, really busy guy. President Obama, as he was leaving office, summed up his work really well in a Rolling Stone article, or a Rolling Stone interview. He said, "I think that what I will miss most about this place, the thing that I can get sentimental about, and I try not to get too nostalgic because I still have a bunch of stuff to do, but it's the team that we built here. The number of young people in this place who are just amazing. Somebody like Brian Deese. Nobody outside of the White House necessarily knows Brian. He must be 35, 37, something like that. He's our Deputy Chief of Staff of Policy," which isn't totally right, but I'm not going to correct the president. He engineered the Paris Agreement, the Hydrofluorocarbons Agreement, the Aviation Agreement, and may have helped save the planet. And he's just doing it while he's got two babies at home, and he couldn't be a better person. Well, Brian also coordinated the policy development for the White House on taxes, financial regulations, housing, clean energy, manufacturing, and the automotive industry. Known as the boy car czar around the White House, Brian is not new to public service. He was voted by his peers to serve as president of his third grade class. And when he was graduating from Middlebury, he was selected by his classmates to be the commencement speaker. They were given the 10 students with the highest GPA to choose from to be the speaker, and to their delight and astonishment, Brian was on that list, earning him the nickname the dumbest smart kid in college. Apparently, he has a good poker face and a lust for life that made it hard to believe he was such a high achiever academically. And as Maine is the ultimate equalizer, I finally got the chance to meet Brian when he and his young family moved to Maine to take a break after leaving Washington, D.C. Brian called me and asked the two most important questions a person with a young family can ask when moving to Maine. Do you know a good nanny? And do you know where I can catch a striper? I was able to deliver on the latter, and I count the time that he and I spent on a small boat in Casco Bay some of the most valuable time I've spent. Brian is a brilliant man, intensely curious, dedicated to making this world better for all of us. He has the talent to do so and is a heck of an angler. Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Deese.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Lucas, for that. I think it was the fourth grade. But I also think that probably the source of data was my sister, and so I'll blame her and not you. The most important introduction that Lucas didn't give was that principally for Maine purposes, the best way of situating myself is that I am Heather Deese Rudin's brother. And also, I'm Pat Stanton's son, who is also happens to be here, and I have to give my mother a shout-out, because they both know a lot more about climate science than I do, and part of the reason why I ended up going into public policy was I wasn't smart enough to become a scientist like my mom or my sister. So Maine has always been a special place for me and for our family. It's where it helped cultivate in me my love of the outdoors. I learned to fly fish on West Branch Pond. And it's been it was one of the great thrills for me professionally in my career, a quarter century later, to be able to be part of helping to bring about the designation of the Katahdin Woods and Waters Monument. But amidst this crowd, I understand that I am and always will be from away. And so tonight I'll want to give you some perspective from outside of Maine about how I see the state to try to protect and preserve our natural spaces and our planet. And my bottom line is that I think that more than any time in history, we have extraordinary reason for optimism. And I recognize that there's a certain audacity, to borrow the phrase from my former boss, in saying that now is a moment to be optimistic or hopeful about the fight for climate change, the fight to protect our air and our water. So I want to talk a little bit about why I believe that's the case and give you a couple of reasons why I think there is extraordinary reason for optimism, and then temper that so you don't think that I'm completely crazy with a little bit of pragmatism as well. So first reason for optimism. For the first time in modern history of this country and the world, we have the markets on our side. And I'll start with a data point on this in this respect. If you were trading stocks and you were to think and try to envision what could be the most pro-coal event in the history of the stock market, you would want to create something that was totally unexpected and something that would definitively change prospects for policy around coal. I think it would be hard to imagine an event more powerfully pro-coal than the election of Donald Trump. It was unexpected. It signaled a definitive change in policy. If you go back and you look at what happened in the financial markets in the week after Donald Trump was elected, at the time it was my job to follow these things. Coal stocks underperformed the rest of the market the first week after Trump was elected. Now, I was looking for reasons to be optimistic and hopeful, so maybe I was cherry-picking data. But then you look at the first month after the election, the first 3 months, the week that Donald Trump went to the EPA and announced that he intended to roll back the Clean Power Plan, and the period since. In all this period, coal has underperformed the market. And the reason I think a lot of us know, either professionally or intuitively, is because the market is sending a signal about where the direction of energy production is going to go in this country. And that's just a specific anecdote to capture something really powerful and something really new that is happening in our economy. In fact, this doesn't rank up among Barack Obama's biggest accomplishments, notwithstanding my dogged effort to try to make it so. But I think one of the most transformational things that's happened over the last decade is the decoupling of economic growth and emissions in this country. For the first time outside of a recession, our country has now experienced a decade in which the economy has expanded, we have gotten richer as a nation, while our emissions have fallen. Our economy over the past decade has grown 12%, our emissions have fallen by 10%. It's an extraordinary thing. It's never happened before in the history of the country. It's so extraordinary, in fact, that I was sitting with President Obama right before he was going to go have an interview with the New York Times. We were in Hawaii, and we were about to travel out to see the Marine Monument, the Papahanaumokeokea Monument, which I can pronounce. We were about to go see it, and he was going to give an interview to the New York Times. And I said to him, you know, one of the things you might want to say in my effort to try to get this up on the list of accomplishments in his tenure is that that economic growth and emissions have decoupled. Growth is up 12%. Emissions are down 10%. And he looked at me and he said, is that right? I want you to check and see if that's right. That doesn't seem right. You go check and see if that's right. So when the president says that, you sort of run around and you say, but at that moment, there wasn't time. The New York Times, the interviewer came in. The reporter sat down with him, started the interview, and so I wasn't able to do so. And about two-thirds of the way through the interview, he looks up at the reporter and he says, you know, for the first time, economic growth and emissions have decoupled. In fact, economic growth is up 12% and emissions are down 10%. The interview finished, and he walked by me, and he looked at me, and he said, you better be right. So I'm really confident in that statistic. You don't have to go check, I promise. But I think that it actually signals something much more powerful about the movement, which is that it signals a fundamental shift in our energy system, but it also signals a fundamental shift in the political economy of this issue. Because for decades, we've been basically viewing the effort to try to reduce emissions as a trade-off and a choice, that you had to trade off well-being, you had to trade off prosperity in an effort to try to reduce emissions or protect the environment. And that's just no longer the case. Those of us who feel passionately about the need to protect the environment can now make an argument in a much more forward-leaning way that doing so is definitively pro-growth. And I think that there's a lot of optimism we should take from that. Second reason for optimism is the pace of this change is accelerating, and it's doing so notwithstanding some policy headwinds. One of the things that perennially frustrated me when I was in the White House and I was working on this issue was that we would constantly get forward-looking projections from the government agencies about the cost of wind, the cost of solar, the cost of battery technology. And they were horribly inaccurate. We never got it right. But the thing that's striking is that we were always wrong in one direction. Year after year, we underestimated the degree to which technological change was going to drive reductions in cost of deployable, cleaner sources of energy, and in technologies to allow us to consume less energy as well. That is happening in the United States. Perhaps even more powerfully, it's happening outside the United States. When we started the diplomatic dialogue with India in early 2015 around joining the Paris Agreement, the conversation was completely calcified. And the reason was because the cost of building a new coal plant in India was less than the cost of deploying solar. And when you are in charge of a country where 300 million people have no access to electricity, and you've made a campaign commitment to provide them all electricity, you're going to go with the cheapest option. Within 18 months, now, today, in auction markets in India, new solar is outbidding new coal consistently by a couple of cents. So the reason why India has come around to be a champion, a global champion of solar, is because the market is driving that change faster and faster. And the last thing that I'll say, it's happening in real time right now, is that for years there's been a sense that the transition to off of fossil fuel vehicles would come. But if you just look at what's happening in the last several months, we now have China, major countries in Europe, major automakers covering significant majorities of the global market, all saying that within the early 2020s, they will have a strategy to completely get off of fossil fuels. And when you think about the intersection with that and technology around autonomous driving, we are on the cusp of disruptive change that's going to continue this pace of driving, of decoupling growth and emissions going forward. Third reason for optimism. Outside of Maine and outside of the United States, the political conversation that we have to deal with on a regular basis is simply not occurring. The rest of the world has moved beyond basic debates about climate science. They've moved beyond basic debates about whether you need to trade off economic growth and reducing emissions. And they have moved definitively toward the view that the next country that harnesses the clean energy revolution will become the next superpower. That is disheartening as a citizen because for the time being, the United States has stepped off of that playing field. But we should all take significant solace in the fact that outside of the United States, the conversation has now turned to competitively, how can we position ourselves to compete and win in these new markets? When immediately after the election in 2016, about a year after we got agreement for the Paris Accord, I went to the next meeting. Every year there's an annual international meeting on climate change. They're called the COPs. So this is about a year after the Paris Agreement. And it was about 2 weeks after the election in the United States. And there was a lot of question about what were countries going to do? Were you going to see backsliding? Were countries going to say, well, if the United States is going to step back from this issue, then we maybe have to step back from this issue as well. And within our delegation, we said, let's try an experiment. Let's try something. Normally in diplomatic circles, you use very stilted language, very careful language when you negotiate communiques. We said, let's try something. Let's put a statement into the communique that says the global momentum behind combating climate change is, quote, irreversible, which is an extraordinary statement to put in a diplomatic document. We said, let's give it a shot. Let's see what happens. We're sure that some country will tell us that we can't say that and we'll have to take it out. And I was astonished. Every major economy we sat across the table from, every major economy, not only didn't disagree with it, but actually endorsed and said, the message that we need to be sending to the world and the message that we need to be sending to our constituents is that the momentum behind this is irreversible. And you've seen in the diplomatic instances since, the G20 essentially has become the G19 on issues of climate change, but you continue to see global reinforcement that the momentum behind this effort is irreversible. Another source, I think, of incredible optimism. So now for the realism part. In the face of all of the market momentum and in the face of the global political momentum, we find ourselves at a moment where all of our core environmental and conservation laws, federal laws, are under attack. We find ourselves in a situation where our basic ability to protect and enforce clean air and clean water for our citizens and for our families is under attack. And we find ourselves in a situation where the basic arguments around science are questioned and contorted in a way that leaves one asking the question of how do we move forward and how do we make progress? And when we step back and we think about the planet, time is not on our side. And so while at a different point in history, if we lost a couple of years, it might be less of an issue. Now the other thing that's accelerating are the actual physical impacts of climate change as well. So where do we go from here and how do we move forward? Let me just offer a couple of thoughts. The first is that even in the face of extraordinary onslaught and threat to a number of the bedrock principles and bedrock statutes that have allowed for so much conservation and climate progress in the United States, I'd argue we still need to be playing offense. There's a lot of defense to play out there right now, but we still need to be playing offense. Climate change is not a second or third tier issue that is to be avoided or talked around when it comes campaign season and left to the policymakers afterwards. Climate change is not an unpopular issue or an issue that we can only talk about in certain parts of this country or certain pockets and certain constituencies. In every county in the country, red, blue, every county, there is more than 50% support for the idea that capping pollution, unrestrained pollution, from power plants is a sensible idea. So one of the things I think we need to do is we need to be less self-conscious about the fact that we're right about this issue. In the last 3 months, the air quality in San Francisco has consistently registered worse than the air quality in Beijing because fires are devastating that region, fires that never happened a decade or two decades ago. We've seen 100-year weather events happen consistently again and again. Let's stop calling them 100-year events and look forward and predict the future when this is going to become the norm. We've seen millions of our fellow citizens in places like Puerto Rico devastated, their infrastructure devastated, by storms that are not anomalies. They are connected to climate change. We don't need to beat around the bush anymore. Our citizens are being put at risk, and we need to do something about that. And we need to be willing to make these arguments and call out when there are people that are trying to threaten our natural habitat and our livelihoods. There are villains in this story. And I think that people understand that. I think that people understand that when you create a political structure where you allow for a lack of accountability and you allow for polluting interests to write laws and undermine basic protections, and like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and the Antiquities Act, that's not what people want. And so we need to be less self-conscious and we need to be more affirmative about saying this is an issue that matters. It matters in our communities. It matters to our kids' health. And we're going to fight for that. We're going to prioritize that. This is not a second-tier issue. Second thing, I think we need to spread the playing field too. Climate change is an issue that affects all of us, and protecting the sacred spaces is an issue that affects all of us in different ways. But we need to create bigger tables and more interesting opportunities for people to come to these issues and understand them and participate in them. We also need to understand that the interconnectedness between an issue like climate change and an issue like public health, and understand that if we can make progress on one set of issues in an environment that is as challenging as it is right now, then we're going to be able to make more progress on other issues. Just as we put climate change and conservation as a top-tier issue, we also can't make that an issue that we say, well, we're going to fight on that issue, but we're going to let other issues slide. And I'll just use a live example in the state today. In a couple of weeks, you all, I'm not a registered Maine voter, but you all will go to the ballot and decide on the fate of 70,000 of your fellow citizens who could or couldn't get health care under the expansion of Medicaid. That'd be viewed as a health care issue. But the uninsured rate in Maine is roughly double. The uninsured rate in rural parts of Maine is roughly double where it is in urban parts. Those are places that where the likelihood, the incidence of diseases like Lyme disease and asthma are higher. And public health issues are climate issues, and climate issues are public health issues. We need to understand and be willing to make those connections and fight for those things as well. And lastly, and I think that this is a place where Maine as a state and the Maine conservation efforts, as a specific example, can really lead the nation. We need to build coalitions and bring people into this movement. But for a unique coalition, we wouldn't have the Katahdin Woods and Waters Monument. We wouldn't have people that wouldn't necessarily think about conservation issues in their own life or wouldn't necessarily think about the impacts of climate change, but are able to see that because people like George Smith are raising the issues of where did that water in that stream go? That was part of my heritage and part of the way I think about my home. And we need to make those connections and create tables where people can come together. I think that that's more important now than ever. I think that Maine is poised to do incredible things in that respect, the work that many of you have done over the last several years, even though there's been a withering assault out of the governor's office to try to tamp that back. The work that has happened in the legislature and the work that's happened outside the legislature makes the state poised to be a clean energy leader, a conservation leader over the next couple of years with the right leadership. And I think that that's another reason for enthusiasm. But I think that to really build on that and to really get back the national momentum that we need to think carefully about how to bring other voices into these debates. The conservation movement and the climate movement have not always been areas where other demographics have felt welcome and have seen themselves in that movement. That's starting to change. The effort to try to bring people of color and urban voices into the climate movement is incredibly important. It's something that that this organization, other organizations around the country, should think more about in terms of how do we make clear that this is an issue that's affecting everybody. It's affecting people in their lives. It's affecting their kids. But it's complicated, and it's gotten very politicized. And so we need to be more pragmatic about bringing people to the table and understanding and listening to them and understanding where they're coming from so that we can move forward together. And I think we can do that in a way that where we are playing office, because we know that this is important. We know this is important and touches people's lives. And so if you start with a bit of optimism, maybe a little bit of audacity, and an audacious belief that we actually have the tools here in the United States and the world to solve these problems, and we roll up our sleeves, we're willing to play a little more offense, we're willing to be a little less self-conscious about making these arguments in a forward-leaning way, and we're willing to think constantly about how do we create new tables and how do we bring those together. I end where I began. I am incredibly enthusiastic and optimism about what could happen here in Maine and what could happen around the country. And I'm excited by what this organization and all of you together can do to help move that forward. So thank you.
Been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today we joined Maine conservation voters Evening for the Environment at Thompson's Point. Brian Deese, senior advisor to former President Obama, was the keynote speaker who wrapped up the celebration of conservation milestones. You can hear the program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click radio to access the program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine. And for Speaking in Maine, I'm Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.